signal to everyone else that I can bankrupt you, I can ruin your career, even if I can't convict you, I can ruin your life.
What happens when a president seeking revenge can order criminal prosecutions against his enemies?
For Friday, September 26th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. This hour, the latest round of tariffs could hit medicine, home furnishings, and more.
Those are price increases that hurt families and disproportionately affect families at the lower end of the income spectrum.
Later, we check back in with a tattoo artist I first met a decade ago.
And the store Anthropology doesn't actually sell rocks for hundreds of dollars, but we'll explain why some people seem to believe they do.
It's a nice rock, and they, like, ethically source it.
What? Ethically source? Babe.
Plus new music from Nico Case after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump says he hopes more of his political enemies will be indicted. This comes after Trump handpicked a new federal prosecutor in Virginia, who then returned an indictment against one of Trump's more outspoken critics, former FBI Director James Comey. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Comey was indicted on two counts related to allegedly lying to Congress in testimony 5 years ago, after Trump demanded that the Justice Department prosecute him. Trump says he expects more of the people who made his life miserable over the last 8 years to be prosecuted.
It's about justice, really. It's not revenge. It's about justice. It's also about the fact that you can't let this go on. They are sick, radical left people, and they can't get away with it. And Comey was one of the people. He wasn't the biggest, but he's a dirty cop.
Comey says he is innocent, and he looks forward to proving it at trial. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
A surge of 13 federal agencies will join Memphis police to help fight crime in the city starting Monday. Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Lee says the influx will include the FBI, U.S. Marshals, and National Guard troops. Christopher Blank reports from member station WKNO.
Since President Donald Trump approved the Memphis Safe Task Force last Friday, wary community leaders have debated enhanced public safety versus the optics of a military presence. Governor Lee stressed a cautious approach.
The operation itself will develop as the need is understood on the ground.
Though the city's crime rate hit a 25-year low in the past 8 months, officials are aiming for permanent reductions.
We don't know how long it will take for that to work, but however long it takes.
To start, the governor pledged more than 300 state troopers and $100 million toward crime-fighting technology. Troops, he says, will be unarmed unless local law enforcement requests otherwise and will have no power to make arrests. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Blank in Memphis.
The U.S. Department of Transportation is tightening the requirements for non-citizens to get commercial driver's licenses. NPR's Joel Rose reports the department says all states must comply with the new rules.
The Transportation Department is announcing the new rules after fatal crashes this year in Florida, Texas, and Alabama. Officials say all three were caused by non-citizen truck drivers who should not have received commercial driver's licenses. The rules will make it impossible for many immigrants to get those licenses because only three specific classes of visa holders are eligible. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy also threatened to revoke $160 million in federal funding from California unless it complies. A spokesperson for Governor Gavin Newsom defended the state's safety record, saying commercial driver's license holders from California have a fatal crash rate almost 40% below the national average. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. From Washington. Senate Majority Leader John Thune is rejecting Democratic demands to boost funding for health care, calling them unserious. But he says a government shutdown is still avoidable. Thune says Democrats need to scale back demands to reverse cuts to Medicaid. An autopsy has detected that the man accused of killing four people last month in a building that included National Football League headquarters was suffering from a brain disorder, CTE. Steve Futterman reports.
27-year-old Shane Tamura targeted the NFL offices. He accused the league of concealing the potential dangers of football. After the shootings, Tamura killed himself. In a note, he said, "Study my brain, please." The medical examiner found he was suffering a low-stage level of the degenerative brain disorder CTE. Tamura played youth football here in the LA area and continued through high school. Chris Nowinski is co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation.
If you start at six and you play through high school, like no researcher who's paying attention to this is now surprised to find somebody who played that long having CTE.
Tamura shot himself in the chest, allowing for a complete study of his brain. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
A black liberation activist who was given asylum in Cuba after escaping from a U.S. prison in 1979 has died. Asada Shakur had been serving a life sentence for killing a police officer. The Cuban government says Shakur died yesterday due to health conditions and advanced age. Her case had long been a thorny issue in the fraught relations between the U.S. and Cuba. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's feature clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Pattersonsclothing.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump campaigned on a promise to use the justice system to seek retribution against his perceived political enemies. And yesterday, the Justice Department indicted former FBI Director James Comey. The DOJ is being rapidly reshaped under Trump. In recent months, his allies have ousted career prosecutors and other high-level employees at the FBI and U.S. attorney's offices. But Comey's indictment marks a turning point. So I'm joined by NPR Justice Correspondent Kerry Johnson and Senior National Political Correspondent Mara Liasson to talk about how Trump is changing the rule of law in this country. Welcome to you both.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Ari.
Kerry, to start with the specifics, what is Comey charged with?
Comey faces two counts. One is obstruction of a congressional proceeding, and the second is a false statements charge. They both seem to relate to testimony Comey gave the Senate Judiciary Committee in September 2020, nearly 5 years ago. And this indictment came in just under the clock. The statute of limitations was ticking away, set to expire next week. Mm. And Comey's testimony focused on the investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election and some alleged media leaks and whether Comey authorized them. But this indictment is so bare bones, it's hard to say exactly what Comey allegedly lied about.
Huh. Mara, what makes this indictment a turning point?
It makes it a turning point because it marks the end of the post-Watergate reforms, which Watergate was a big ethics scandal involving the president of the United States, Richard Nixon. And these reforms enshrined a bunch of norms. They weren't laws. They were norms that were supposed to prevent presidents from intervening directly in the affairs of the Justice Department. The idea is that justice was blind. It was supposed to be meted out fairly, not with regard to whether you were a friend of the president or an enemy of the president. And previous presidents, since the Watergate reforms, have followed these norms. They weren't required by law. They followed the norms because they thought it was a good idea to show the American public that there was a level playing field and the rule of law applied to everyone. That's now over.
And this one case fits into a broader effort by the Trump administration to remake the Justice Department. Kerry, what have you seen in your reporting?
The DOJ this year, really in just 8 months or so, has been shaken to its core. We've seen attacks on career federal prosecutors, mass firings, and also mass resignations of career prosecutors who said they were asked to do things that were unethical, wrong, misrepresenting things to courts. We've also seen the administration go after big law firms and very harsh executive orders. And this Justice Department has actually sued the entire federal court bench in Maryland over an immigration issue. So the White House, in one way or another, has been really trying to destroy some of the pillars of the justice system as we know it.
Yeah, look, this really is part and parcel of what the president ran on. Donald Trump is extremely transparent. He tells you what he wants to do, and he goes ahead and does it. He ran on a program of retribution and revenge, and he said he wanted to use the Department of Justice to be his personal revenge agency. He specifically told the Attorney General to go after specific people, including Comey. He said, do it fast. He clearly understood the clock was ticking. And the interesting thing is, it doesn't matter if this case is weak or strong. He's sending a signal to everyone else that I can bankrupt you, I can ruin your career, even if I can't convict you, I can ruin your life. That's the message.
This obviously has huge impacts for law and justice in the United States. Carrie, what are you hearing from people who have worked at the Justice Department for years?
Yeah, people who are still inside the Justice Department and those who spent decades of their career there are really shocked at how rapidly the department has shifted. And they're really shocked, Ari, at the loss of credibility among some grand juries in D.C. and Los Angeles, the lack of credibility that some Justice Department lawyers now have before courts. It's astonishing to them that how much damage has been done. And Comey said last night after his indictment that he really felt heartbroken for the Justice Department. That's a sentiment that many share.
As people are being fired or resigning en masse, who's replacing them?
Well, take, for example, a woman named Lindsay Halligan. She's an insurance lawyer who came into Trump's orbit in Florida. She has no experience as a prosecutor. In fact, Trump had put her in charge of sifting through the Smithsonian museums for what Trump called woke ideology. Lindsay Halligan actually is now the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. She is the person who signed Jim Comey's indictment. She appears to have gone against advice from career prosecutors in that office that the case against Comey was weak and the evidence was lacking. But Lindsay Halligan is the one who stood up in court yesterday and made statements about protecting the rule of law. It's unclear whether any other lawyer in that office will actually show up to prosecute Comey or whether Halligan is going to have to do it by herself.
Mara, you pointed out that President Trump promised to do exactly what he's doing. He's been very transparent about his intentions. Did people just not take him seriously, or were they unable to stop it?
I think they were unable to stop him. I think after the first term, people started taking him more seriously. But also, it's really hard to figure out how to stop him. I mean, this is a president who believes, as he says, Article 2 gives me the right to do whatever I want. Article 2 is the article that set up the executive branch. This is his concept of the presidency. It's, some people think it's an authoritarian concept, but what, you know, other than refusing to do what he tells you, quitting, or allowing him to fire you, there's not that much that individual people in the Justice Department can do unless Congress is going to assert itself or unless the courts are going to assert itself. But what we've seen in this transformation of government during Trump is that the executive branch is getting more and more powerful and the legislative branch and the judiciary are withering.
And Chairs Mara Liasson and Carrie Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, when Ari spoke with the singer-songwriter Nico Case about her memoir, he said that he thought her music often sounded like the gray skies and green hills of Washington State, where she grew up. Well, Nico Case has a new album out called Neon Gray Midnight Green. I hear a hole where the scrape and the drag of my cannon should be. I hear a hole. This is the first solo record for Nico Case in 7 years. And here to talk about it for our new Music Friday series is Evan Miller from member station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Elsa. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being with us. So I know that you've already spent some time with this record. What are your first impressions?
Well, I can say quickly, the short version is that it's brilliant, and I think a notable record of this year that rewards repeat listens. Nico Case hasn't exactly been quiet over the past 7 years since her last record. Her band, The New Pornographers, has put out a couple records in the meantime, and she wrote this new memoir that we've already heard about. This record is a really strong reminder of how vital and singular of a songwriter she is on her own. And topically, it covers a lot of ground, but it pays particular attention in tribute to collaborators, friends, musicians, activists, producers that have passed away in her orbit over many years. There's one in particular
Dexter Rahm Weber of the duo Flat Duo Jets, who was a longtime inspiration for Nico Case. And the track Winchester Mansion of Sound is a really exceptional memorial for him.
So you string a few together just to bang them all around and build a tragedy's momentum. You're a Winchester Mansion of Sound.
Well, I also understand that this is the first album that she has ever produced entirely herself, right? Like, she's been putting out records for, what, over 25 years?
Yeah.
So what does the production sound like on this one?
It's dense. It covers a lot of ground. There's power pop. There's chamber music, string flourishes. There's the Americana and girl group style harmonies that you can expect. There's a track that's just her and saxophones duetting that's bizarre in the best way possible. I think this record really is a testament to how wide her range is musically and how she can do basically anything, especially with her voice in tow.
Well, I saw that she told the website Stereogum that she wanted the record to sound like it was made by real people. What do you think she meant by that?
I think that's a testament to the humanity of the record and how it talks so much about people. I think it makes a lot of sense for this record to sound like people. There's breaths, there's creaking and shuffling around. It sounds very warm and lived in.
I remember nothing but the horizon. I ate miles and miles of the horizon.
I think the human element of the music is displayed so lovingly by the production. You can tell it's a bunch of people in a room all making music together.
That's so cool. So can you take us out on one of your favorite songs on this album?
Yeah, I really like Wreck, the third track on this record. It's a jaunty, like bouncy little number. It has this really fun drive to it.
Please come back soon.
There's strings swirling around. Nico's voice is soaring through the whole thing. And she's sort of spinning this cosmic love metaphor, which I think really fits the sounds on it. It's a really fun earworm on this one. Go listen to it a million times.
Is Evan Miller from WYSO. You can hear more of his analysis on today's New Music Friday podcast from NPR Music, and Nico Case's new album, Neon Gray, Midnight Green, is out now.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912, fsbbigfork.com, member FDIC. Join Itasca Pride for tree planting at Northern Lights Community School in Warba Saturday, September 27th from 11 to 2. Besides planting trees, you can enjoy a free barbecue, live music, games, and disc golf. Support comes from Thrive Up North, sharing the stories of a welcoming community of people who've chosen to make Itasca County their new home, promoting all the area has to offer, including natural amenities and jobs in healthcare, manufacturing, and more. Offering an incentive package to help with your move to the area. Learn more at thriveupnorth.com. Beltrami County Historical Society in Bemidji hosts an author reading tomorrow at 6 p.m. Hear readings from the new edition of North Country Journal, which features stories of remarkable Beltrami County women. And we receive support from Bemidji Brewing, celebrating 10 years of their German Blonde with a week-long anniversary event, September 30th through October 4th. Includes beer infusions, events, pop-up shops, and live music. Find full details on their Facebook page. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There will be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments, learn more at avalara.com/property tax. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As President Trump threatens more layoffs of federal employees, some people dismissed by the administration earlier this year have a message. They want their jobs back. But despite a win in court, the chances of that seem slimmer than ever. NPR's Andrea Hsu brings us one worker's story.
Back in February, tens of thousands of probationary federal employees were terminated en masse, mostly more recent hires. They were told it was for performance reasons, even though many had gotten stellar performance reviews. There were lawsuits, a couple of them, and earlier this month, U.S. District Judge William Alsup issued a final order in one of them. He said the terminations were not lawful. Jessie Beck, who lost her job as a fisheries biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, was relieved to see it.
It's very validating to see a legal order that really reflects the illegality of our experience.
Judge Alsup wrote that the government's actions were arbitrary and capricious. In ordinary times, he suggested he would have ordered the government to reinstate employees, but he didn't do that. He explained the Supreme Court has already made clear it would overrule him. His decision left Jessie Beck extremely frustrated.
It seemed like the judicial process is being undermined by a higher court.
Beck also took issue with assumptions Judge Alsup made. He wrote that terminated employees have moved on with their lives and found new jobs and would not be willing or able to return to their posts.
That is not true for me, and that is not true for many of the probationary employees that I've been talking to.
Beck was 10 months into her job working with fisheries in Alaska to find ways to better protect seabirds. She'd come to work for the government after more than a decade doing related work at a nonprofit. She wanted a more direct role in figuring out solutions to conservation challenges. And then came the Trump administration's purge of probationary workers. Even after all she's been through, she says she would go back if she could.
Yes, immediately I would return to my job. As would many, many others. We loved our jobs. We worked really hard to be there. And a lot of us have found other work to fill that gap. But a lot of us have also taken pay cuts to do so.
Beck, who's now 38, has been piecing together short-term work. It's not nearly enough to make up for what she lost. She and her husband were trying to have a child when she got fired. The lack of financial stability has complicated that.
It's been a real lesson in living in uncertainty.
One thing she is waiting for is a letter from her agency stating that her firing was not actually tied to her performance. In fact, Judge Alsup saw the importance of this and ordered agencies to issue such a letter back in April. Agencies complied, sort of.
You mean the apology, non-apology?
Back in the spring, the government sent fired employees a letter saying what the judge had told them to say, that their termination was not performance-based. But that letter also essentially said that the government didn't believe it, that it was only complying with a court order, and it would appeal that order. Now, Alsup has given agencies until November 14th to issue a new letter. He told them not to, quote, lard it with such language. Once again, the government has appealed. Beck worries she'll forever have a mark on her record.
It's going to make it difficult to explain to future employers outside of the government, and it will absolutely make it difficult to get another federal job.
She says it's already hard enough to get her career back on track. Under the Trump administration, a lot of funding for science has been cut. And there are a lot more people out there looking for jobs. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Sometimes the internet provides us with a main character, someone or something that people online have become obsessed with. Well, our producer Mia Venkat is very online, and so for my last time on All Things Considered, she is here to explain to me what the internet is obsessed with this week. Hi, Mia.
Hi, Ari.
What is it? Who is it?
Okay, so I know you're decently online, but I'm
decently
still almost positive you won't know the character this week.
Hit me.
It's not a person, but it's an object.
Okay.
It's the Anthropology Rock.
Is that a song or is that like a pet rock? You really have no idea what you're talking
about. Thank God. Okay. So it's not anthropology like the field of study. It's anthropology like the store. They sell home decor. Yes, anthropology.
G-I-E. Yeah. Peasant skirts and stuff like that. Yeah.
Sure. If you're not familiar with the store, which you kind of are, their products are on the more expensive side for retail chains. And this content creator, Phoebe Adams, posted a video on TikTok unboxing a package in front of her boyfriend saying she just bought this rock, a plain rock, from Anthropology on sale for $150.
On sale?
Wait, you bought this?
What do you mean I bought this? This is like the cutest rock ever. It's going to sit on our entryway table.
It's just a... How much?
It's not just a rock. It's a one-of-a-kind rock that they found in the ground.
That's where rocks come from.
Paint a picture. Is it like a colorful rock? Is it a geode? Is it polished?
So those are all the right questions if it was real, but it was a prank. It's just a rock that she found outside. Anthropology does not sell home decor rocks, and I hate admitting this, but I fell for it too. I was like,
really?
And then this turned into a trend where all these women started pranking their partners, usually male,
they all unboxing the Anthropology these rocks.
And that they purchased from Anthropology for like various ridiculous prices. Here are a couple examples from TikTok users Macy Moments and Sam and Jess Official.
I've always wanted this. Do you know how much this is?
That's where they got
this.
That
is $850.
We got it on sale, though. We got it on sale.
Mom, it's a rock.
No, it's the Anthro rock.
The Anthro
rock. It's a nice rock, and they, like, ethically source it.
What? Ethically sourced?
No child labor digging these rocks out of the dirt.
That's right. Ethically sourced rocks are. Come and get them while they're hot.
Okay, but why Anthropology specifically? Why this brand?
Yeah, I thought about that too. Like, there's a reason it's so believable, right? They clearly have this kind of reputation where it wouldn't be a ridiculous home decor item for this brand to sell. Like, I looked at their website and they sell a $350 throw pillow. And they have like a nearly $600 like fireplace broom and dustpan.
I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop has sold rocks.
Exactly. So it's not an insane thing.
Yeah.
And so that, I think that's why it took off. It's kind of like when the streetwear brand Supreme had the Supreme logo brick that they sold. It's like of the same genre, I think.
Has Anthropology responded?
Okay, they have. And they took kind of an all press is good press kind of approach to
totally.
This. Because you can interpret this trend as a joke on them. But they just fully leaned into it. They posted a TikTok where they invited the original girl who posted about it to one of their stores in New Jersey. And they, when they get there, there's a full display in the front selling rocks for like $1,000 with price tags and everything.
Wow, inflation keeps going up.
And even the employee there like fully gaslit the boyfriend.
It's only $1,000.
Oh, no. Those are on sale right now, actually. They're 50% off.
They are? Yeah. 50% off?
It's literally a rock.
But we can't keep them.
This poor boy. But I reached out to Anthropology, and they didn't comment on their overall marketing strategy, but they told me that the rock display in the video was just fully for the video purpose, and they're not currently planning on selling any rocks.
Just proves there's no such thing as bad publicity, because here we are on my last day on All Things Considered talking about Anthropology
That's
stores.
That's right. And Ari, because it's your last day, do have something for you.
Oh, my God. Do I get a rock?
I told you I went on a field trip yesterday.
Oh, but
it's
this was
special.
Ethically sourced,
right? It put me
right?
back a couple $100.
Wow. But, it's a rock that is painted that says the Ari Shapir rock. Thanks, Mia. I'm going to treasure
something.
This forever.
You know, it's a public media. We don't make a ton of money. So.
NPR's Mia Venkat.
Thank
I'm going to miss these conversations.
Me too.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise. Playing in the street. Gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face. You big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place, singing we.
The Ari Shapir Rock. This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. The Minnesota Department of Transportation has an open house from 4 to 6, Tuesday, September 30th at Park Rapids City Hall. Learn about the Highway 71 corridor study. There will not be a formal presentation, so you may come and go as you wish. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Minnesota regulators are considering testimony they heard Thursday on a proposed acquisition that could set a new tone in the world of public utilities. A decision is expected soon on whether Minnesota Power should be sold to a private equity firm. The Public Utilities Commission votes next week on a petition for purchase of the utility by Global Infrastructure Partners. The Canada Pension Plan Investment Board would be minority owners. A recent settlement with the State Commerce Department added some conditions, but Maggie Schupert with the rural community advocacy group CURE says they still worry the new owners will focus on profits, setting a dangerous precedent.
Clearly, if this deal goes through, private equity interests, they see the arguments against it shot down, they're going to know that our utility sector across the country is open for business.
Schupert and other opponents contend that because of how the deal is structured, ratepayers could face higher utility bills. Utility officials say the new owners would give them financial flexibility to meet the state's mandate for carbon-free electricity by 2040. In a non-binding opinion this summer, an administrative law judge said the deal would not be in the public's interest. The PUC vote is expected October 3rd. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. An attempt to create a new statewide nonprofit health system with the University of Minnesota and Fairview and Essentia Health Systems has ended. Chelsea Perkins explains.
The Minnesota Star Tribune reports that people close to the negotiations who were not authorized to speak on the record said there was an impasse over the proposed structure, leading to Essentia Health exiting the talks. This leaves the U with limited time to create a new agreement for the long-term future of the medical school with its current partner, Fairview Health Services, which is set to expire at the end of 2026. The university operates the state's largest and only public training program for physicians, and the medical school uses Fairview's University of Minnesota Medical Center as its primary teaching hospital. The Essentia Health proposal was announced in January and called for creating an all-Minnesota health system solution that would include a $1 billion joint investment over 5 years. A person close to the talks said Essentia opted out of negotiations after it became clear Fairview would not merge into a proposed new nonprofit health system led by Essentia. In a statement shared with KAXE on Thursday, Essentia Health confirmed it is no longer part of the mediation through the Attorney General's office. Essentia says this is because the strategic facilitator determined the provider no longer had a role in the process. But they say that process is distinct from broader conversations happening with the university to support the medical school in, quote, preparing the current and future healthcare workforce. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Leech Lake Tribal Council members, Itasca County Commissioners, and even State Senator Mary Kunish broke ground Friday for a new community and wellness center in Ball Club. It's the third such groundbreaking this year, following the state legislature's 2023 investment for three wellness centers on the Leech Lake Reservation. Kunish says the investment was long overdue.
They will take our land and in exchange provide housing, healthcare, education, opportunity to, you know, have a trade that would be able to be sustainable for our communities. And we know that our federal government and even our state government never really upheld those agreements.
Ball Club's representative on the Tribal Council, Kyle Smith, says these centers serve a huge role in Indigenous communities.
Our communities are very tight-knit. You know, we rely on families for supports and family gatherings. Mm-hmm. And it's just a way of life for our Native communities.
The Leech Lake Band also formally entered into a memorandum of understanding with Itasca County, which Commissioner John Johnson commemorated with a special gift to Chairman Farron Jackson.
I hope that that this unfinished pipe is as meaningful to you and the council as it is to me, because I hope it is exactly like the relationship between Itasca County and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and that it remains unfinished.
Construction on the new wellness centers is expected to take about 1 year. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump is calling for steep new tariffs on imported medicine. In a series of social media posts, the president also threatened to slap double-digit import taxes on home furnishings and heavy-duty trucks. Trump's tariffs have contributed to rising prices, but so far that has not led people to cut back on spending. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now with more. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Okay, so tell us about these latest tariffs, which I think are supposed to take effect next week. Is that right?
That's right. Trump says starting October 1st, which is next Wednesday, he plans to impose a 25% tariff on heavy-duty trucks, a 50% tariff on kitchen cabinets and bathroom sinks, and a 100% tariff on brand-name pharmaceuticals. Now, the White House has not offered a lot of detail beyond the president's social media post, but Trump hinted there could be some exceptions. For example, he says drug companies that are in the process of building new factories in the U.S. would be exempted from these tariffs. And it looks like generic drugs would also be exempted. So those are two pretty big carve-outs.
Okay, but some of Trump's tariffs have been challenged in court, right? So how does that affect these new levies?
Trump has relied on a 1970s emergency law for a lot of his tariffs this year, and critics have gone to court saying that law doesn't actually give the president the authority to impose tariffs. Mm-hmm. So far, the courts have agreed with the critics, and the Supreme Court is set to hear arguments in a little over a month. But that challenge would not affect these tariffs because they're authorized under a different law, one that is designed to safeguard national security.
Oh.
Now, some might question whether, you know, kitchen cabinets or bathroom vanities are actually vital to national security, but at least the security law does give the president explicit authority to impose tariffs.
Okay, well, so far, what effects are tariffs having on, say, people's pocketbooks or on people's spending? Like, what are you seeing?
Yeah, people are still spending money at a pretty good clip, at least in the aggregate. This morning we learned that personal spending in August was up 0.6%, which was a bigger jump than forecasters expected. We also got some revised figures earlier in the week that showed spending during the springtime was stronger than first reported. That led to a pretty big upward revision in second quarter GDP. Now, the pace of spending would seem to be kind of at odds with a lot of survey data, which shows people are generally grumpy about the economy. But economist Shannon Grine says that hasn't caused them to lock up their wallets or tighten their purse strings.
I've been surprised more times than I care to admit just how resilient the U.S. consumer is. While there's still risks of, you know, an inflation pop here or some concern from tariffs, households are still spending and going to continue to try to spend until they're not able to.
Grine notes that even though hiring has slowed down, the job market is still in pretty good shape. And so long as a lot of people are working and earning money, they're probably going to keep spending.
But is there any sign that spending power is wearing thin at all? Or?
Yeah, spending increased faster last month than people's paychecks did. And obviously, there's a limit to how long that can go on. Mm-hmm. Some people drew down their savings in August or relied on plastic to keep up their pace of spending. Greg Dacko, who's chief economist at EY Parthenon, says that we're kind of in a two-speed economy right now, where a lot of the spending is being fueled by upper-income families whose houses are worth a lot of money and whose stock portfolios are doing great. Meanwhile, lower-income households are just kind of scraping by, especially as tariffs drive up the cost of things they have to buy week after week.
Whether you're thinking about food prices, apparel, autos, or now potentially drugs, those are price increases that hurt families and disproportionately affect families at the lower end of the income spectrum.
By contrast, tariffs have less effect on the price of things like travel and recreation, where a lot of well-off families are spending their money.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
For the past decade, tattoo artist Brian Finn has been offering free or reduced-rate tattoos to people who want to cover over scars. Scars from trauma, domestic abuse, human trafficking, self-harm. I met Brian on a different reporting trip to Ohio in 2015. A small piece about his work in the Toledo City Paper caught my eye, so I stopped by his studio.
The cost of equipment is not that much. It just takes up my time. So if I can make somebody's day better, life better, just covering up a scar from a bad experience, I sleep a little better.
Well, in the last decade, Finn has done thousands of free or reduced-rate tattoos. So for our series Here to Help on Volunteerism in America, I wanted to check back in with him. Brian Finn, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm great. I can't believe you're still at it. When I talked to you in 2015, did you ever imagine you would be doing this a decade later still?
Not really. I mean, I didn't really have any plans to stop, but yeah, it just kind of keeps going.
Why did you first decide to start doing this on your days off? What gave you the idea originally?
It just kind of hit me one day that I had the tools to do something to help people, and everybody I was surrounded with said that they thought it was a good idea, so I just kind of rolled with it.
And was there immediately a surge of demand that's just never let up?
There was after our first interview, which really kind of got me because I was under the assumption that most people knew that you could cover up a scar with a tattoo. And to this point, I think it just kind of brought awareness that, you know, it is possible. And from that, you know, there was people that reached out from all across the world, different tattoo shops, different tattooers, saying, hey, I heard that on NPR. I'm kind of following suit and I'm doing the same thing. You know, that was Brazil, Ireland.
And so it's not only that clients poured in asking for your help covering up scars, but other tattoo artists picked up the idea and started doing it all over the world.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was more so bringing awareness. So that was kind of the biggest take back with that. So it was really nice. There's still people that reach out to me every single day, every other day. Hey, I live here, and, you know, it's maybe thousands of miles away, but they're asking if I know anybody or could recommend anybody or, you know, if the scar is healed up enough to go over. So just giving them as much information as I can.
Over these 10 years, have you seen changes in the kinds of people who seek you out or the kind of tattoos that people want?
Not necessarily any changes in the tattoos. I think everybody kind of chooses something different. I've noticed that some people, you know, they want to cover up a scar with a tattoo so they can't see it. But there's a lot of people, too, that came in that they wanted to kind of highlight it. And it's, yeah, everybody's different. And I think both are great ideas and just a different approach depending on what you want to do.
Has this experience changed you?
I think it definitely has changed me quite a bit. I think that it's less overwhelming. I think that's the biggest thing. I think at first, hearing everybody's story all at once was more than I expected.
Yeah.
So emotionally, it was, you know, it was a lot of pain to hear on a daily basis. But I think now I just have a different perspective of it to where it's nice to help people out.
You think you'll keep doing it until you retire?
I don't see any reason to stop, you know?
Well, Brian Finn, it is so good to talk to you again a decade after we first met. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
He's a tattoo artist in Toledo, Ohio. And we want to hear from you. To tell us your own story about how being a volunteer has shaped your life or to nominate someone you think we should profile, go to npr.org and search Here to Help.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Bobby Brown has found huge success as a makeup artist, business mogul, and TikTok star. In her latest book, Still Bobby, she's looking back on her life. And on Wildcard, she spoke with Rachel Martin about creating a brand that changed the beauty industry with its simplicity.
What's a piece of advice you were smart to ignore?
Oh, that no one needs another makeup company. When I told someone I was going to start a makeup company, uh-huh. This guy said, the world doesn't need another cosmetics company. Uh-huh. And he could have been right, but I proved him wrong.
How young were you at the time?
I actually started doing a line of lipsticks when I had my first baby. So I was 32 when my first baby was born. So I would be on the phone with editors giving tips how to wear makeup and look fabulous as my newborn baby was throwing up on top of me and trying to pretend I didn't have a baby, right? That I was just this fabulous person.
Right.
You know,
that was the time when you didn't advertise motherhood. No.
And I was living in the suburbs of New Jersey. Why would Vogue write about, you know, someone in the living in the suburbs?
And part of your origin story is that you were making makeup that wasn't, I mean, you had all this experience working in high fashion and doing these amazing elaborate photo shoots with lots of makeup where you focus on the makeup. And your whole thing was like, what if we just didn't do that? What if we just like minimized it, which was revolutionary at the time. Now we take it for granted because everyone is like natural. But it was a huge deal when you did that.
Yeah, I remember there was a cover of a magazine I did where I don't know even what got into me. No one discussed it. I just did her makeup. I put a pencil inside her eye and I took a bronzer and I kind of put it all over her face, on her lips, on her cheeks, on her eyes, gave her some mascara, and oh my God, she looks so pretty. I mean, this girl must have been 19 years old.
Right.
And they shot the picture. Oh, Bobby, it's so beautiful. And it became a cover. And I was like thrilled. And I remember showing it to a top makeup artist. Look at my cover. What do you think? And he says, oh, that's not makeup that people want. If you do makeup like that, you're not gonna work in this town.
Also, we should say, men, I mean, there's a lot of men telling
men.
You
yes.
how right. to do makeup.
Right.
And what
men
women
in
want.
Suits.
Men in suits telling
really,
you.
Men in really nice suits, yeah. There was token women, mm-hmm. but they were mostly men. Yeah. You know, there were token women, and there was a lot of women, you know, that just, and a lot of men that just said yes. Yes, a lot of, I was kind of the one that said, no, I don't think that's right. I don't think people want that. I don't think people need that. You know, and let me figure out what the needs are in the market that you're asking me for, and let me try to do it my way.
And you can watch that full conversation with Bobby Brown by searching for Wild Card with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Her new book, Still Bobby, is out now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business. With an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Cross Lake Days are now through Saturday, September 27th, with an arts and crafts fair, live music, cornhole tournament, and more. Find a full schedule at crosslake.com. Greater Lakes Area Performing Arts and Pequot Lakes Community Theater present Annie, September 27th and 28th, at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Saturday's show is at 7, with a Sunday matinee at 2. The Brainerd Lakes Area Walk to End Alzheimer's is Saturday, September 27th at Forest View Middle School in Baxter. Registration begins at 9 a.m. with a ceremony and walk at 10. Hooking up a car seat. It can be tricky. Are you positive your child's car seat is installed correctly? Now's the time to be overprotective. Drive smart and get your precious cargo home safely. A message from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Fire in the Village has a Migwich Monoman celebration and feast Saturday, September 27th from 2 to 5 at the Ball Club Powwow Grounds. Enjoy food, art, and sharing wild rice stories. Loon Country Arts hosts the Great Northern Art Show tomorrow from 11 to 4 at the Beltrami County History Center in Bemidji. Meet local artists and explore jewelry, paintings, photography, and more. Learn about a year in the life of North America's woodpeckers at the Sac Zim Bog near Meadowlands, Saturday, September 27th at 2 p.m. Meet at the Lois King Education Center. Butterfly enthusiast Allison Barta will give a presentation at the Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji Wednesday, October 1st at 6 p.m. This year was her 15th season of documenting butterflies in the area.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the early days of the pandemic, Wilco frontman Jeff Tweedy was on a road trip with his sons, Spencer and Sammy. They were driving from Chicago to New York to retrieve Sammy's things when it became clear that in-person college wouldn't be happening anytime soon.
And during that drive, we listened to Sandinista in its entirety. Ring, ring, 7 a.m., move yourself to go again. I'd had that record, The Clash, you know, Sandinista, since I was a kid. And I think there's one maybe very long section of the record that is another song played backwards. I think at the time, that was one of the ideas of a triple record, is you could experiment and just get as weird as you wanted to be.
Tweedy says the inspiration for his new solo project, the 30-song triple album Twilight Override, came from that long car ride listen.
And just kind of questioning why records have to be predominantly one shape.
Thematically, Twilight Override examines the pandemic-related trauma Tweedy says we're all still dealing with.
I think we lived through something extraordinarily stressful together. We don't talk about it a whole lot, and instead of it bringing us together, it was divided into two separate realities and contested.
But the project is also about an optimism somewhere on the horizon.
My mind is moving fast, faster than my stash can last.
There's a song called Twilight Override, but the lyrics in the song actually have a reverse syntax. It says,
oh.
Override Twilight.
Twilight.
I think at some point I was just like, what am I trying to override? And Twilight is such a beautiful word. It came into my mind probably because of that, because it's just a lovely word. But then, you know, it stuck because it has such a resonance with a lot of the things going on. This sense that if we're not a part of an empire that's dying, we're at least a part of a period where a lot of people feel that way. But it's also, there's a glimmer of hope in it, because where that place where light and dark meets is beautiful.
My mind is moving fast, faster than my stash can last. I'd love a quiet day.
It seemed like a title big enough to contain 30 songs.
I mean, Jeff, this album feels so intimate. As a listener, you're sort of immediately transported to being in that space with you and all of your collaborators. And I know that you mentioned that across the records, there's a lot of group singing around one microphone, as well as choral singing. Is there a track you'd point to where that shows up here?
I think you can hear it most on something like Blank Baby. Just love singing with my kids. I love singing with Macy and Seema and Liam. There are groups of family harmonies in there, and then, you know, just a really intimate, it's just an intimate sound.
Ask you about the song Lou Reed Was My Babysitter, which I know some longtime fans may already be familiar with. If I remember right, this is a song that you brought to the band, but ultimately it wasn't the right fit?
Yeah, I think with Wilco, that song was around for different sessions, maybe as far back as Cruel Country. You know, I don't mention Lou Reed in it, but it's about the things that I always hated about going to see bands and realizing that I missed them.
I want you to dance into me. Spill my drink. I want to feel the kick kicking in my teeth. My bleeding heart, bleeding to the beat.
about standing in an audience and being bumped into and having smoke blown in your eyes, all the different things. I think the title really comes from the sensibility of the song would absolutely not be there if I wasn't entertained and consoled and kept company by Lou Reed, Velvet Underground, my record collection, rock and roll. It's just an ode to, or an appreciation of how wonderfully human and beautiful that all is.
Ask you about one more song if I can, and it's the song Feel Free.
Feel free, get on the floor and dream.
Can you tell us a bit about it?
That phrase is a little bit of a Rorschach test. You know, you could hear it and think, it's dismissive. Oh, if you want to do that, it's your life. Feel free.
Feel free, hail Satan. Doesn't matter to me. Or you can be the devil every Halloween.
And it also could be a sort of directive. If you can think freely, if you can, or not think at all in a freeing manner, that's good. you should do that. I wanted to collect as many things like that and put them in this song. And then I also wanted to collect things that I don't agree with and put them in the song, but with the understanding, or at least the attempt to understand, that it's someone else's approach to feeling like they matter and they belong and they're part of something.
Jeff, you have so many diehard fans. I wonder, as you're making music now, to what degree are you thinking about how to draw in new audiences, perhaps even younger audiences who aren't familiar with your solo work or even with Wilco?
It's a hard question to answer because, to me, the music I've made in my life seems to be multi-generational in its appreciation now. I do see families. I do see very young kids at our shows and when Wilco goes on tour. So I just think I'm reaching out to make some connection. And the people you end up making connection with, I think, are the people that kind of get it.
Feel free, let it be, or let it bleed.
We've been speaking with Jeff Tweedy. His new triple album is Twilight Override. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Feel free. Feel free, think of your name on a marquee. Aim for something you can't see.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Programming is supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project. Weather tonight, increasing clouds with temps in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Tomorrow, sunny with highs in the upper 60s, low 70s.